Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's Spoolcast. And I have for you an amazing treat. We have the amazing, the awesome Chris Risden, who is at Adaptive Path, now part of Capital One. And he's just an amazing person to listen to talk about how you actually take a user experience and map it out. Hello, Chris. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, sir. Thanks for having me.
Chris will be presenting a day-long workshop at UX Immersion Mobile April 13th through 15th in Salt Lake City. For more information, visit uxim.co.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So there are folks on the planet, really smart, intelligent folks, who, for whatever reason, their paths have not crossed this idea of mapping user experiences.
I don't believe it.
No, it's true. It's true. And you can map them out, I hear. What does that mean, mapping out a user experience?
Sure. And it's funny that you phrase it that way, because we used to ask in 2011, when I started teaching this, I'd ask, you know, how many people have done something like this, map the user experience or do customer journey mapping, whatever sort of semantic kind of version of this you want to do. And, you know, if you had a room of 40 people, you'd get like two or three people who've done something like this, maybe even four. And then I ask it now, and as recently as when I've taught it like a month ago, and I get a room of, say, 40 people, and I get probably at least half the room raising their hands. They've tried this. It doesn't mean they don't want to sort of get a good foundation, like coming to the workshop and see, like, well, what are different ways is this can be done, or where does it fit? Kind of get certain questions answered. Where does it fit in the process? Or is there something I can do better? But so many more people are at least familiar with that, and I think that's great. So what it is, and, you know, what we hope that the kind of niche that it fills is, at its simplest, it's an articulation of research. It's a means of articulating insight, right? So you have this insight, and you can do research reports. There's other things you can do, like personas and concept models and mental models. This one sort of hit the sweet spot the past few years in seeing that there was kind of new complex design challenges. And maybe they weren't new, but an emergence of more complicated design challenges where you either had to think across channels. So you might be in digital, but you had to at least consider the digital world in the larger landscape of customer service channels like call centers or physical retail stores or even just the marketing materials they did. And you had to start thinking about how even digital ecosystems that didn't have those different channels were used differently over time and space. And so sort of across channels and across time and space, because one day you might be using something on a mobile phone and the other day you might be using it on a desktop in a different way, that kind of created a need for a tool that, I guess, within the user experience field, even though this isn't new, I didn't and we didn't invent it, just wasn't as widely adopted or understood of where it could fit in. And so it kind of just hit a sweet spot of need based on these emerging challenges that user experience designers were having.
One of the phrases I've heard you use that I just love is designing for moments.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's how I thought about it. And it's because, you know, if you're designing for a screen, you might be designing for features and you might be designing for how you get a task done. But when you're designing for something that might involve maybe multiple channels in sequence or simultaneously, like I might be in the physical store using my mobile phone or something like that, then you have a lot of things going on, but what you really care about is a moment. And if you do realize that maybe your product or service sort of lives within a journey that somebody has. That journey might be a week, it might be a month, it might be a full shopping journey, it might just be the journey for product returns. Whenever you have those, you can call them touch points, you can call them interactions, but it's really about a moment within that journey. And you know that most journeys involving products and services are made up of a few key moments, and you really need to nail those key moments, I guess you could say, to deliver on your value proposition successfully and create a successful experience for that customer.
Yeah, the other day I was in a city that I'm not that familiar with, and I was rushing out to a meeting. I was in my hotel room, I was on my laptop, and I brought up the email that had the address of where I was trying to go. But what was really cool was that when I brought up Google Maps on my phone, that was like the top search entry. I didn't have to do anything. Google knew that if I was looking it up on my laptop, I probably also want to look it up on my phone. And that was a moment that someone had designed for.
Right. And I think that's really important. I've just been a big fan of thinking about it sort of in those terms. And one of the reasons I champion either thinking about touch points or thinking about moments like that is because you know, if you think about things like features, it's kind of an inside out way to think about it, but it also doesn't really translate to parts of organizations that aren't digital or aren't dealing in screens and software, you know? And so I've been trying to think of ways to think of things that can be shared, you know, concepts that can be shared across organizations, because a particular moment like that, really, even if it's still screen-based, it has to think about the context that it's in, and that can involve all kinds of things, you know, where you are, like you said, laptop or mobile, on the street or inside. And so really thinking about those terms, I'm hoping, kind of distills it a little bit and really thinks at the essence of like, well, what do we care about? We care about delivering at this point in time, you know, delivering on a specific need at a specific time and place. And I think that's what you were articulating about that moment. And that's why I've hoped to sort of boil it down a little and use that kind of vocabulary, not just for us who might be in the digital realm and thinking about user experiences on screens, but also when we're having to think about how to design to support things that also exist in physical environments, marketing materials, or call centers, and what can we share in rallying around? Well, we can share that there might be a moment that involves all of those things, but what we care about is designing that interaction point, that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is going to be really important when we get to start building things for devices like the Apple Watch, because I could imagine, you know, I spend a lot of time in airports. I don't know if you've heard that. And I could imagine, for instance, having my watch know where I am in the airport and telling me important things like what gate to go to based on the fact that I've made it past security, or what seat I'm in once I actually start boarding. One of the things I've learned about airports is that jetways induce short-term memory loss, because I often know what seat I'm in when I'm at the top of the jetway, but by the time I get to the bottom of the jetway and I'm ready to get on the plane, I've completely forgotten what seat I'm in.
I do that too. I'm like, oh, I can put this paper ticket away. What am I? I'm 35F. Okay, I can remember that. And then I tuck the paper away, so I have one less thing in my hand that I'm trying to juggle, and I get on the plane and I'm like, what was that? That was 36F, right?
Exactly, exactly. Or, you know, when I walk into the hotel lobby and I'm standing by the elevators, it should tell me what floor to go to. Because one of the tricks of doing a lot of business travel is that when you've stayed in three different hotels on three different nights, you try all three hotel rooms.
Right.
Before you get to the right one.
And that's one thing, I mean, in the workshops, I try to talk about how one of the reasons we do this, yeah, this isn't by itself. It usually accompanies like a traditional research report, but it's a good way to show how you can be smarter about what your customer's doing so you can look smarter to them. For example, context is really important. And what this really gets down to is understanding the context that different interactions are occurring, different moments occur, and you realize they're post-security or their pre-security or whatever, you know, that example is. And so you get better insight about that. And then parts of the organization get better insight about it, because the phone center knows exactly what's happening when people call. And the screens might even get really smart with their GPS and other things about what's happening when they interface. But rarely do different parts of the organization have the full picture. You know, everyone has their sort of siloed picture, their snapshot of the picture. So yeah, getting a little bit smarter about what's going on in the journey so you can help that way. I didn't used to think about it in these terms, but the big framing I've put it in is that it's a hub of empathy, understanding, and strategy. Like, it gives you this insight around the user from those perspectives.
So say a little bit more about that. So the hub is
empathy, understanding, and strategy. And so, you know, number one, we're dealing with more complicated design problems. You know, that's kind of one of the things I've posited, is that, you know, we have to think about different platforms, different channels. You know, we're integrating different frameworks for doing this within an organization, like customer experience, or we're sort of bringing in different disciplines like service design, and where we're really thinking about complicated systems now, not just, you know, a screen that we know is going to be used by someone sitting at their desk. And so I've sort of said, well, our challenge now is we can think about all these moving parts so much, and we can get lost in that, that it's hard to maintain empathy. So the question is, how do we maintain empathy in the face of that increased complexity? And that's one of the reasons we hope experience mapping can help do that, because it's meant to show how it's being experienced. And then, you know, obviously it's a sense-making tool, because a lot of times we don't know. I know what's going on in the call center. I know what's going on screens. I know what's happening in the stores. But from a sense-making, we also often don't know what that whole journey looks like. And even more importantly, we don't know. When I say journey, I should even clarify that We don't just think about the journey that someone has with our product or service. When I implement this, I really promote that it's about understanding the larger journey within which our product or service lives. So it's not thinking about being an airline passenger, a passenger of United or Southwest. It's about traveling and being a traveler. And when you knew you needed to make a trip from when you came back, and if it was a vacation, when you came back and posted Facebook photos, and then looking at the role that your product or service has within that larger journey. So there's a sense making sense. So there's the empathy part of making sure that even though we're dealing with all these more moving parts, we don't lose sight of the fact that we need to be human-centered and empathetic. There's a sense-making, like, well, we need to know every part of what's going on, not just our little sliver. And then we try to use it as a catalyst for strategy. Like, once we have this as a hub, we can move up and we can say, like, okay, well, we can create service blueprints to show how we can support this journey through the people and processes and technology. We can roadmap it and identify opportunities. We can do process engineering, and we can, you know, help change our organization through this lens of understanding this holistic experience as a hub. But we can also move down and say, like, okay, we now need to take this individual moment, one of these key moments, and somebody's going to have their marching orders to design for that moment. And they need to know, what are the dependencies? If I'm designing a screen, how does it integrate with a call center if I need to? And, you know, what are the interactions that have to be involved? And so I call it a hub because you can kind of move up and down. You can move up strategically and organizationally. You can move down and take a moment, but design for it with a richer sense of context and sort of the DNA of the whole journey now that you have that shot, that snapshot.
One of the things that I'm curious about is, you've now been practicing this. I mean, when we first talked about this back in, I don't know, 2012, you'd been doing it for a couple of years. So that means that now you've got at least a half a decade of doing the sort of journey map stuff under your belt.
Next year will be, yeah, almost.
Yeah, so I'm curious now what successes you've seen teams have because they've done this.
Yeah, I mean, it's all been anecdotal that as far as externally, but that's been one of the reasons why I kind of thought I would teach it for a couple of years and it'd be out there and then that would be done. But the two things that kind of happened. Number one, it's such a great tool for me to learn just by showing up at workshops and talking to these people about what they've already tried and what their challenge is going in. And one of the reasons why, even if they've done experience mapping before, why they might be at the workshop. And so the second thing is that it's changed a fair amount since I was teaching it in, say, 2012. Less from, even though I get to do these projects a few times a year, less from what I've done and more from what I've learned from what other people are doing. Usually one of the biggest outcomes, which was one theme before that I think has just grown just because it's what I've heard as far as what I talk about helps doing, is the kind of cross-functional uniting that occurs. You know, yes, it's great that you get the actual insights that it's meant to get, but I always say that it's about the verb, not the noun, and meaning the activity of doing it is almost as important, if not more important, than the actual artifact you get at the end that you can agree upon. It's like, wow, okay, we have a sense of what this customer journey is like. But the fact that if you've done it, I don't want to say right, like there's one way to do it, but if you've done it kind of the way I tend to promote it, you've done it as a cross-functional group. You brought in parts of the organization. Just like I was saying earlier, you know, the .com team knows exactly what's happening on the website and the call center team knows exactly what's happening, but often never the twain shall meet. It's like we're not having insight to create a complete picture. We now have different parts of the experience, or different parts of, you know, the journey or experience, but we just don't know what that whole picture looks like. And having everyone in the room is half the battle. When you can actually get five or six stakeholders, you know, they could be the versions of product managers and UX leads from those different parts of the organization, but just having them in the room to share the knowledge and to sort of be along for the ride of getting the insight that's not limited to one aspect, like the insight of what people are doing when they're calling, or the insight of what people are doing when they're on the website, the insight of what people are doing when they're traversing both channels. That's probably been where I've heard some of the best success stories, where they say, like, you know, it was probably a challenge to start getting people convinced, and even just things like finding time for people in the same room because we all have our own agendas. But once they did it and they spent a few weeks going through this process, the usual success stories is they actually would change parts of their organization. Like, either they'd find ways to have representation from each other's sort of silo in each other, or they'd find new ways to communicate, or they even post experience mapping, they'd find ways to come back and sort of integrate their roadmaps together so they understood, like, this is where we're both delivering something that from the end user should be feel like one thing, even though it involves the phone channel and the website or something. And so the success stories have usually been around how they've actually changed team or organization dynamics. And that's been probably the most rewarding part. There have been project success stories. There have been, you know, success stories where, we've been able to prioritize pain points and address those. And then 9 months later, we did a new experience map, and it was really interesting to see how it changed and then reprioritized. But it's probably been the team and organizational dynamics actually having a longer-term change after doing one of these processes or exercises.
It's interesting to me that designers often talk about what they want to do is do more strategy work. And it feels to me like they think that that's some master switch on the wall that you pull down. You know, in the up position, it's pixel-based design, and in the down position, it's strategy design or something like that, you know, and you just have to wait until you get permission to flip the switch. But the way you're describing this, it almost feels like by introducing this tool, you end up doing more strategy work just by the nature of mapping out the experience forces you to talk strategy along with the, well, what are the specific ways we're going to get this screen to do that thing? And it's almost like we back into it. It's like you wake up one morning, you go look in the mirror, you go, oh my gosh, I'm doing strategy work.
I mean, that's really it. And I think that's one of the types of people we see are people who are designers and realizing either they need to or they want to get more involved earlier, meaning like I want to be part of the generation of insights and then looking at those insights. And this is kind of a window to looking into those insights so that we can sit there and actually talk about what we should be doing instead of, you know, getting features handed down to us or requirements. It's like, oh, here's something happening, you know, at this point in time, at this place. You can kind of point to it on a map. You know, it's like an actual map. You can point to it. And then what should be happening here? Or, you know, maybe nothing's happening here and it's not even bad, but maybe there's an opportunity for something to be happening here. And then what you're doing is you're discussing strategy, right? You're planning out what you should do. And that's going to eventually result in marching orders of go ahead and do it and go make something. So I think that is the case. One of the models that I use is that sort of ubiquitous double diamond. I think it was like the design council or somebody came up with it, you know, the diverge, converge, and then diverge, converge, double diamond. And that first diamond, you know, for those that don't know, the first diamond is, you know, you diverge, you open up because you want to get all these inputs and you want to understand from a wide range of ways you can get inputs from interviews and observations and surveys and, you know, qualitative and quantitative. And then you kind of close the other half of the diamond because you're narrowing in on the insights. You're synthesizing and sense making and you're getting it. And then the second diamond, you know, you open it up because you want a lot of different ideas. You don't want to constrain yourself too much. And then you close it again because now you're separating the wheat from the chaff and you're seeing which ones are worth testing or piloting or prototyping, and you get more and more focus into design. And that's a long-winded setup, but to talk about where, you know, the experience mapping comes is I specifically frame it as something that helps you make the leap from the first diamond to the second diamond. It's a connector between them because it helps articulate your insights, but in a way you can actually plan on what you want to do into that second diamond. And so that's kind of a long-winded way to frame it, but it's to that point where it becomes a strategy document. Even though I think of it as an articulation of research, it's specifically a type of articulation of research that allows you to talk and plan and sense make and basically set yourself up for that second diamond, that second wave of actually making something.
The double diamond, that first divergent thing, that's the, you know, there are no bad answers, there are no dumb ideas part. And then the convergence part is actually, yeah, there were some dumb ideas.
Exactly. But we'll start by saying, like, if there's this point on the map that we want to affect, we'll be saying, like, what are different ways this could happen? You know, I use case studies like a hotel. Like, what are different ways this hotel check-in can happen? Or what are different ways this, you know, airline check-in can happen? And just different ways you could deliver that product or service experience. And so at that point, we're saying there's no bad answers. But if we articulate our insights right in that map, we've done other things. They may be personas. They could be principles like design principles or experience principles, which I'm a big proponent of. Then when you have that, open up that second diamond, takes all of these ideas and see which ones map back to the opportunities you identified in the map and or the personas you crafted that, you know, have these certain needs that need to be met and or these design principles that you know your design should adhere to or strive to live up to. That's basically, you know, you're taking the things that helped you make the leap to that first diamond and you're making sure after you've gotten all those no bad ideas out, you have something to filter through. You have a litmus test to say, like, well, we have something to actually determine of these 100 ideas, which 7 or 8 might actually be worth pursuing further.
One of the things that I'm curious about is, do teams run into challenges when they're trying to do this, particularly when they're getting started?
Yeah, getting started is actually probably one of the hardest parts, and I've never had a silver bullet on how to do it. It's probably anything I talk about or teach. People say, like, well, how do I get, you know, people involved who aren't normally involved, or how do I introduce this? And usually what they want to do is say, hey, I learned this new thing, and let's start doing it this way. And what I found is you usually have to set the table in a way that doesn't affect essentially other people's ways that are going to be evaluated. Like, they have their thing, they're doing it, they might be running different parts of the organization. And so doing something too radical too suddenly is, like, kind of scary to them, because they already know how they're going to be evaluated. They already know how their performance, or the performance of their group, or their performance of their output is going to be evaluated and judged. So they don't want to introduce something kind of risky. And often at this stage doesn't have this, like, instant ROI attached to it. It's usually the things you identify through the map that you will start to measure. It's not impossible, but it's hard to, like, measure a whole journey. But the journey is a great way to take parts of it that can be measurable that you want to change. So at this early stage, you don't know what that looks like yet. And so I frame it as, they usually need to set the table. I mean, it might even start as simple as having conversations, maybe even having brown bags where people from other parts of the organization you want to be involved. You can be invited. Nothing's going to change yet. And, you know, showing them some case studies or some examples or some success stories, and then thinking about, very typically, thinking about how they could do something like this in a small way. And one of the things I talk about is how there's no set journey. You can journey, I mentioned this before, you can journey a full shopping experience, or you could journey the product return experience. It might have enough number of touch points and channels involved. I might have to look up the return policy. I might physically have a receipt. I might still have to go to the store. Somebody, you know, as an employee, has to use their judgment of whether I'm doing it. There's lots of things that are happening. And so you can kind of take something small that you know will be a quicker win, because it'll be more bite-sized as far as actually being able to affect change there, and then look at that as a success story. And then you can always pick other journeys, or you can zoom out the scale and say, well, now let's really look at our whole picture. So we can identify other areas like the product return area that might need further investigation, further zoom in, or might be obvious that we can tackle this in a unified way. So I think that's one of the challenges. One of the challenges is that where to start. And so it has to kind of start small, which is pretty typical. I mean, you hear that from a lot of methods, but small in a way where you're not even maybe doing it yet. You're doing brown bags and stuff just so people can sort of feel safe at first by doing it, versus saying, like, oh, you want to do this? Sure, wait, I'll sign off on it and let's just do it and have faith. You actually have to, like, really introduce it to them.
It feels to me that what happens is you develop a comfort with this. Like almost any technique, particularly in design, there's a starting point where you're just sort of figuring it out as you go, and it feels a little bit like you're making it up as you go. But as time goes on, we start to get comfortable. But because it's a team activity, the whole team has to get comfortable with it, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good point. And that's usually it. And it's going to usually be introduced by somebody, often a designer, like the people that come to my workshop. And they need to be, and this is one thing I've really tried to evolve as I've taught the workshop, as I've seen this need, they really need to be good facilitators of this. I mean, that's why I really think about how I teach people to introduce it to their organization. And I kind of teach, like, well, what's the responsibility of you? You're not just going to say, hey, look, this is what I learned, and so now let's all do it together. You almost have to be that center for facilitating and knowing it. And that kind of puts the burden on that person to have, in a sense, retain more from the workshop, so to speak. And I try to make sure that, you know, the deck that follows up and everything feels like they can get that support. But one of my favorite times is when I hear about the second, and it might be 9 months later, it might be a year later, but the second time that they've kind of gone through this big activity is because, like, everyone's all familiar with it. So I really like hearing that story, because they do feel like, well, we did it the first time. We identified opportunities. We actually roadmapped those, so we knew what we were tackling when. And when we tackled those things, we had that better sense of the moment that we were designing for. So it worked, and to different, you know, levels of success. I mean, sometimes there's challenges as well. So I'm not saying like, oh, out of the box, they did it, you know, awesome and they loved it. But at some point at the end, they saw the merit in it enough that, you know, in somewhere between 6 and 12 months later, they revisited it to do like, okay, now that we've changed some things, now the journey might actually be being experienced in a different way, it's worth doing. And that's always good. Whether it's 6 months or 2 years, it's always good to kind of revisit so you can, you know, see how the journey's evolving. And it's usually when I've, now that I've been doing it long enough that people have done this like a second time and around, it is very exciting to hear like, and we just knew that we needed to do this, not we needed to sell it, not we needed to teach people how to do it. It's like they understood, you know, the value of it, and they understood kind of where it lives in the process and what we're trying to get out of it. Even though for different organizations, that's a slightly different thing. But nonetheless, when I hear that, which I couldn't hear in 2011, 2012, because it hadn't been long enough, but now in 2013 and 14, I'm hearing how people have gone through this a couple times. That second time is really great to hear about how, you know, you didn't have to sell it and you kind of knew what you were doing with it. And that's really good to hear.
Is this one of those things where down the road, you actually can't imagine that there was a time when you didn't do this?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, for me, it's that way clearly. And that's not just because I've got this cottage industry of teaching it. It's, you know, one of the reasons I've liked continuing teaching is because I've just seen such a useful reason for doing it in my projects. I'd like to hope that that's what other people are getting out of it as well. And again, if we're right in syncing this as a tool at the time when people are facing this real cross-organization or cross-channel kind of more complicated problem, then yeah, I think once you start doing it, again, you're going to do other things. And that's why I kind of call it a hub, because it's a place to start around getting a consensus across groups and channels and divisions and silos. You get that, then you're like, well, yeah, you need that, you know, call it a hub or call it a binder, but you need that kind of connective tissue that I think this provides.
How important are walls, right? Is this one of those things where if you can put this up on the wall so everybody can be in front of it, is this something where, you know, having a wall for this stuff to live becomes a really sort of almost water cooler-like experience for the team?
It's just about a requirement. I mean, first off, the way I teach the process, it shows that you don't just say like, okay, we need to map the customer journey. So can you, designer over there, can you open Illustrator and create a map of our customer journey? I mean, it, because it's a collaborative process.
And then let's put it in a PDF on SharePoint and never look at it again.
Exactly, exactly. So first off, as a group team, I'm a big advocate, if you can, you know, have some type of project room or war room. I mean, whenever possible. And this is kind of one of those things when I talk about how organizations have changed, you could talk about some success stories, is one thing I've seen are organizations, it feels like a small thing, but for some organizations that are large and don't have this, where they've been able to say like, oh, this meeting room that always used to be a meeting room, we've been able to commandeer it for the next 6 months and just make it our project room. And this has never been done in our organization. Like, to me, that's a huge success win. And they have this room where they'll put up the map, but there's so many things that are complementary to the map. It might be those personas. It might be these design principles. And not only as a project team are they then creating this place that they can reference and that they can make messy, but people pass by it, right? And they pass by it and they look in and they can see something. And even if it's kind of a mess, there's a story to be told about kind of what I call the through line, like the traceability. Like, there's research, and the research begat insights, and the insights begat journey maps and experience principles, which begat these ideas and concepts, which begat these prototypes. And that's often one of the hardest challenges people have at any phase of those things, is making sure that they feel justified and connected. Why did we do research? Why did we pay for it? Well, why should we make prototypes and invest in it? And when you have sort of a place where you can show the through line or the traceability, it goes a long way. And then you can also socialize that map throughout other parts of the organization. We're big advocates of well, but even just having this like centerpiece place, you know, where it's the physical hub to this, you know, paper hub or this artifact hub, I think is really important.
Well, there you go. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I present to you the evidence that Mr. Chris Risden is an amazing individual who knows his stuff. Chris, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the compliment, and thank you for taking the time to have me. Appreciate it.
I got to say, if you guys listening to this are just blown away by how exciting this experience mapping stuff is. You need to come to Chris's workshop. It's going to be at the UX Immersion Conference that's going to be in Salt Lake City in April 13th through 15th. We are very excited to be there. We're very excited that Chris will be there with us. It's going to be a great conference. He's going to do a full day on this. You're going to build out experience maps and create these hubs and design for moments.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's the marketing material right there. I
like there you go. So come sign up. UXIM.co will tell you all about it. Chris, thank you again for sharing your brilliance with us today.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to April.
Yep. And I want to thank our audience for listening to us today. And as always, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you again. Take care.
For more information about Chris's and the other five workshops, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. As always, thanks for listening.